good afternoon, everyone. We'll welcome you to ITIF. I'm Rob Atkinson. I'm president of ITIF, and many of you know ITIF, but if you don't, we're a relatively new think tank in D.C., just over 2 years old, and our focus is almost exclusively on thinking about and writing about policies that relate to innovation and for competitiveness, productivity, including in the IT space. So we're really honored and pleased that they have Bill Lewis here to talk about the issue of productivity in a book he wrote. So I'll introduce Bill in a minute, and also Ike Brandon, but I just want to take a minute to acknowledge former Congresswoman Nancy Johnson is here, and Nancy is co-chair of ITIF along with Cal Dooley. So we're really pleased with her leadership of ITIF and joining us today. So, let me introduce Bill and then Ike, and I'll make just a few introductory remarks. We'll turn it over to Bill for about 40 minutes of comments. If during his comments you have pressing questions that can't wait, go ahead. I encourage you to hold those questions. Ike then will make a few comments, and then we'll have probably 30 minutes time for discussion and questions at the end. For those of you who don't know, Bill, he was a partner at McKinsey for over 20 years and was director of McKinsey Global Institute, which is the firm's economic think tank. If you actually are not familiar with MGI, I'd encourage you to do that. I think you can still get free email updates, which I somehow am not on your email list anymore. I'm got to get back on it. They do really very innovative work. So some of the most innovative work out there, and it's free, which is great. At least a lot of it's free. So he founded that in 1990 and retired from McKinsey in 2001. Prior to his time at McKinsey, Bill had several policymaking positions in the U.S. government. He was acting United States Secretary of Energy, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was also a provost at Princeton and a senior official at World Bank. So I think he basically had a job in every sector of our economy. And his perspective, I think you will see.
He couldn't hold any of them.
A jack of all trades and master of none. He also is a Rhodes Scholar and a PhD in theoretical physics from Oxford. I don't know if you know Pierre de Vries, but Pierre is on our advisory council. He has a PhD in theoretical physics from Oxford as well. So, he's widely published, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, The Economist, and most importantly, in my view, is this groundbreaking book, I believe it was 2004, called The Power of Productivity. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to get it. You can buy it on Amazon. For a debate about such an important issue, there's very little really good analysis and knowledge on this, in my view, and Bill's book makes, I think, groundbreaking insights there, and you'll see that. As a respondent, we're also pleased to have Ike Brannon. Ike is a longtime colleague of mine and is now an economist in the Treasury Department. Before that, he was a PhD economist for the Joint Economic Committee, worked on in that capacity for Senator Orrin Hatch. And Ike, I'm now blanking on your bio. I know you have a PhD from either Wisconsin or Indiana in economics. Thoughtful economist, thinks a lot about these issues of productivity. So let me just make a few quick comments. It's striking to me, both here and in the U.S., how little attention productivity gets. When you go to other countries, for example, at least in my experience, most other countries, their focus of their economic policy is on how do they get more high-tech firms, how do they go up the value chain. Almost no attention focused on how do you raise productivity across the board. And yet, in many cases, that's their primary challenge. India, for example, Indian retail productivity, this could be a McKinsey number, I don't know where I got it, is 7% of U.S. retail productivity. Chinese productivity is 15% of U.S. productivity overall. So for these countries to grow, they can't just get some software jobs or a few semiconductor factories. They have to figure out a way to grow their entire economy, productivity across the board. You know, domestically, we have a strange view. Domestically, the principal focus on the economy is the business cycle. So whether we're up or whether we're down, it doesn't make any difference. If you look at the average article in the New York Times or the Washington Post on the economy, probably 75% of them, just by a little count I did once, are about business cycle issues. And I know this is heretical to say, given the fact that we're in the middle of something going on. We don't know what it is. Just a little factoid. GDP since 1990 has declined in 5 out of 70 quarters. Not very much. Now, if you basically say, what would be better off, having a decade with no business cycle downturns, or having a decade where we double productivity growth from 1.5 to 3%? The answer is clearly the latter. The economy would be almost twice as large if we had higher productivity growth with cyclicality as opposed to no cyclicality and low growth. But cyclicality is the thing that gets all the attention, not the growth rate. The second problem, I think, in the U.S. is we've got a growing and, to me, disturbing policy view that growth no longer matters. And this is predominantly among the left. We've written a paper, it should be out there, I hope, by a colleague of ours, Steve Rose, wrote a paper, Does Productivity Still Benefit the American Worker? And the answer, according to Steve, who you can't get to be a more liberal economist than Steve Rose, he was in the Clinton administration, he's a solid hardcore Democrat, but he's also a solid labor economist, and the answer is clearly productivity growth still benefits the average worker in America. So there's a notion out there that a number of people on the left say that productivity is just for the rich, just for business. It's simply wrong. Now, to be fair, income inequality's gone up. We need to address that. But to sort of abandon productivity, as I think some on the left want to do, is a big, big mistake. The last problem we have in this country in terms of policy productivity is many, many economists, like your typical neoclassical economist, has a view that you can't really do much about productivity. Alan Blinder, head of CEA under Clinton, for example, says, quote, nothing that economists know about growth gives us a recipe for adding a percentage point or more to a nation's growth rate on a sustained basis. Well, at that point, you might as well give up, because economists are telling us we can't do anything. Why should we even bother to think about public policies? Paul Krugman says, this was when Paul Krugman was an economist, said, quote, productivity growth is the single most important factor affecting our economic well-being, but it's not a policy issue because we're not going to do anything about it. So when you have economists essentially advising policymakers that the single most important thing we can do is raise productivity, but we don't really know how to do it, there's nothing we can do, and we're not going to do it, it's not a surprise that there's no real serious thought to productivity policy in Washington. Now, if they'd all read Bill's book, which I hope they will, then we'd get some serious thought and some serious ideas about how to do that. So, Bill, with that introduction, I'm looking forward to hearing your remarks, and thank you.
Well, of course, if the rest of the world had our productivity policies in place, they'd think they had died and gone to heaven. So if you think we're bad, I'll tell you about some other cases. I'm going to talk to you about my book. Now, those of you who know about a book, I mean, it's pretty thick, got a lot of stuff in it. So in this short time, I can only give you just a smattering of the conclusions and hopefully enough of the evidence and enough of the arguments to persuade you to look more deeply into the book. The book itself, unlike a lot of books, is based on 12 years of research compiled in thick 200 to 300 page McKinsey reports, again, free on the web if you just go to McKinsey's website. So the book is a synthesis of a very large body of underlying knowledge, and this talk, of course, is the tip of the iceberg of the synthesis itself. So you're not actually going to get very much of the real story, but that's the tyranny of this situation. If I can get the first slide to move.
I can actually do it.
Just hit the down ticker. Okay. This chart is a chart I have spent an awful lot of time looking at. As you can imagine, a consulting partner in McKinsey for 20 years probably has a few thousand charts go through his hands over that time. And there's no question that this chart has been the most meaningful chart I ever held in my hands. And it's probably been used and reproduced and viewed and commented on more than any other single chart I was exposed to. This is the best single picture of the world's economy roughly as it stands today. The vertical axis is GDP per capita, the amount of goods and services produced per person at the right exchange rates to compare different countries. That's a technical matter we can go into if you want to. The horizontal axis is the population of the world, all 6 billion people, with the width of the bar for each country proportional to the population of the country. So you then look at this chart and say, well, describe to me what the world looks like. Well, being a former McKinsey consultant, the first thing I look for is, well, what are the segments? I mean, how does the world divide itself? The World Bank and the IMF spend hours agonizing over this. It's really simple. You just look at the chart and there's a natural segmentation in the world. There are the rich countries, the blue countries, about 1 billion people living in the blue countries, the Western democracies in Japan, and there are the poor countries, the yellow countries, all 5 billion people living in the poor countries. It's a little bit arbitrary where you stop the yellow band, but right after Mexico, the curve begins to go up very steeply, and I'm sorry, given the position of that seat, it's hard. This curve begins to go up very steeply, so it's roughly at the point of Mexico, Poland, South Africa. The other striking thing about this chart is that there are so few countries and so few people in the green belt. These are the middle-income countries. These are countries that have GDP per capita somewhere between 25% of the U.S., if you take the U.S. at 100, and 70% of the U.S. Only 340 million people, or 5% of the world's population, live in countries that comprise almost half of the total per capita income width. If you take 0, 0, and the U.S. is 100. And the countries that are in the middle income band are all anomalies in one way or another. South Africa, Poland and Spain, clearly cases of arrested development. Israel is in there. Saudi Arabia, an unusual country, if there ever was one. Maybe the only halfway normal comprehensive economy in that band is South Korea. Korea, and you could even argue that's a special case because of the Korean War and Korea's geographic position. South Korea really became a ward of the World Bank and the U.S. after the war. So we really have two segments. And so the great challenge for us is that the shape of this curve is what it is, and it has not changed in the last 50 years. 50 years ago, the shape of this curve was almost identical. It was somewhat lowered for everybody, but the shape of the curve was identical. We have made no progress in changing the shape of this curve in the last 50 years, and if you think this is a substantial indictment on the Bretton Woods institutions, you're exactly right, because we all thought 50 years ago, the World Bank and the IMF were created to change this situation. And basically, it hasn't happened. It now will be a problem in the next 50 years in a way it has not been a problem in the previous 50 years. Because now the frustration, the envy, the wounded pride, and the desperation of people living in these poor countries can manifest itself in ways it could not in the previous 50 years simply because of the increased interconnectedness of the world. You're as aware of that as I am, so I'm not going to go into it. So, the two questions are, how do we change this, really? What haven't we understood? A sub-question is, well, but what if we don't change it? What happens? I don't want to talk about that because that's too miserable for me to contemplate. I do speculate a little bit about it in the book. I'm going to focus only on what have we missed and how do we change this? We have had an enormous number of natural experiments occur over the last 50 years. If I now begin to talk like a scientist, that's because I am thinking about this like a scientist. Economics can't run control experiments, but it has an awful lot of natural experiments which have not been mined in anything like the way they should. This chart shows net-net that there have been two successful development paths in all the history of economic development. The vertical axis here is the same axis we were looking at, GDP per capita, with the U.S. taken at 100. The horizontal axis is total labor and capital inputs per capita. In everyday language, that's the total effort made towards creating economic value per capita in a country. For the economists in the room, you'll immediately realize that the slope of a line from the origin to any point on the curve is what economists call total factor productivity, or the total efficiency with which an economy uses the inputs of labor and capital in generating economic value. So, two successful development paths. In the middle, the bright colored lines are the Western democracies. They have been on what I call in the book the high productivity path. They all have increased their GDP per capita by increasing total factor productivity at a very rapid rate. There's another development path that has also been successful. I call it the Japan path. And you can see Korea is following the Japan path almost lockstep. This is what I call the resource or input intensive path. You generate a lot of GDP by increasing the amount of capital invested and by increasing the number of hours worked. This is not an original conclusion of this body of work. Paul Krugman, when he was an economist, wrote about this in his famous article in Foreign Affairs probably 15 years ago, and that wasn't even Paul Krugman's work. It was actually the work of Alwin Young at Boston University. What we have learned now that we didn't know then is that the Japan path has its limitations. There is only so many hours you can work and only so many shovels you can give somebody who's trying to dig a hole if you want to get more hole dug. And Japan basically ran into that constraint. And so the Japanese economy has stagnated in a way over the last 15 years or so that nobody would have anticipated back in the 1980s. Korea has also had its own problems. It had it earlier than Japan for reasons that I go into in the book, but we don't have time to go into now. I will not disparage the Japan path, because Japan is the only country to go from poor to rich in the last 100 years. So what they've accomplished is really major. It's just that it's not sustainable, and so they have a problem now. Most of the rest of the world is clustered down here in the lower left corner, struggling to mobilize enough capital and labor and use it productively enough to get off that poor GDP per capita plane and into middle income country levels. Next chart. It's working.
Yep.
Okay. So, how do we get GDP per capita to go up? It's an identity that GDP per capita is equal to employment per capita times labor productivity. It turns out that around the world, most people of working age work. The fraction of people in countries around the world who are adult and working age do work. So the variation in GDP per capita is not explained to much of a degree by employment per capita. The great variation is in labor productivity, the efficiency with which people work when they do work. Again, this is not a new observation of this body of work. Economists have known this forever, that the correlation between GDP per capita and labor productivity is very, very close. Economists have, as a result, struggled with their powerful statistical tools to try to understand what causes the differences in labor productivity. And they've looked at all sorts of variables, the skill level of the personnel, the capital, the technology applied, the scale, the capacity utilization, and something they call the X factor, X efficiency, the way work is organized, organizations of functions and tasks. Of course, they only have data for the things that are easily measurable, like labor and capital, and they use proxies for skills, generally education. And when I was starting this work in 1991, I talked to Ed Dennison here at Brookings, who, as some of you know, really did the pioneering work in this statistical analysis, applying it, of course, to the Solow model of growth, for which Bob Solow won the Nobel Prize. And Ed was anxious to talk to me because what he said, and he handed me a pile of reports, he said all these so-called regression analysis or correlation analysis explained at best 50% of the variation in GDP per capita. In many cases, their so-called residual factor was negative. They didn't explain anything. In fact, it went the other way. They got an opposite result. And Ed was very excited about what we were going to do because he said, our generation has, this is 1990, begun to suspect that the answer has got to lie in your world, in the micro world of how work is organized, how work is conducted, the efficiency of work. In other words, the productivity with which people work. Unfortunately, his health was not well good then, and as many of you know, he died within a year of that conversation. But sure enough, now, 17, 18 years later, we have documented with an enormous amount of empirical evidence that Ed was exactly right, that the by far the largest factor explaining differences in productivity is how work is organized at the firm level. And you add all that up, and of course you get productivity at the sector level, and you add the sectors up, and you get productivity at the national level, and you add that up and multiply it by employment, and you get GDP per capita. So the answer lies down in the details at this point. And of course that now begins to explain why economists haven't been able to get at it, because basically that's not what they do. Next. I have 10 conclusions in the book. I'm only going to race through 5, and you don't have to read this because I'm going to go through each one. I've led up to this first conclusion already, that sector level analysis is necessary to find the causal factors of economic performance. And Japan is the great case to illustrate this. Japan is such a good illustration of so many points in the book that I love using it as an example. When we started our work in 1990, the conventional wisdom in this country and abroad was that Germany and Japan had come out of the war with an economic model superior to the U.S., and that the U.S. was going to have to change or fall behind. And Clinton campaigned in 1992. On that platform, he appointed Bob Reich, who was a great fan of the German apprenticeship system, as the Secretary of Labor. He appointed Laura Tyson, the Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisor, who was a great champion of strategic trade, as she thought was practiced by Meaty. Of course, it really wasn't, but that's what she thought. And she wrote a book about that. Well, at the time, buried in the appendices of the OECD International Comparison Tables was a chart showing GDP per capita of all the OECD countries at purchasing power parity exchange rates, which are the right exchange rates to use in comparing GDP per capita. All the publicly viewed comparisons at that time were using market exchange rates, which are almost useless for this purpose. And those tables showed GDP per capita in the U.S. was still 20 to 30% above Germany and Japan. So here we had a paradox. The papers were full of the stories of Japanese industry shutting down one after another U.S. industry, consumer electronics, machine tools, driving the machine tool industry into niches. And we all know about the problems it caused the automobile industry. And yet, the OECD table said, well, it's not true at the aggregate level. So what was right? We had, that was the paradox on whose resolution I based the starting of our research program. We were going to resolve that paradox. And this is the resolution of the paradox. We did 11 different case studies over the course of the Global Institute's work, not all at one time, on Japan, and I put them all together in this chart for the book. And as you can see, the vertical axis is the relative productivity of each of these sectors in Japan given the corresponding sector in the U.S. at 100. And the horizontal axis is the employment in each of those sectors, with the width of the bar for each sector proportional to the employment in the sector. So, yes, there are a handful of manufacturing sectors where Japanese manufacturing productivity is well above that in the U.S., and in fact, it is the best in the world. And these are about the only sectors, the only concentration of sectors in any of the economy where the highest productivity in the world is not in the United States. But it is clearly, for about half of the manufacturing sectors, the highest productivity is in Japan. Steel, automobile parts, metal, machine tools, cars, consumer electronics, all the things that we were having trouble with in trade. So the Japanese earned their trade success not because of Meaty, not because of gimmicks they were playing with the exchange rate. They won it the old-fashioned way. They won it by having higher productivity, and so they deserved it. We then assumed the rest of the Japanese economy was like this. So we thought they had a superior model, and we made up all sorts of reasons for how they could be successful. But yet, if you look at the other sectors, if you look at the other parts of manufacturing, the largest manufacturing sector in terms of employment in every economy we studied is food processing. Food processing. Who pays any attention to food processing? Productivity in Japanese food processing is one-third that of the U.S. It's not internationally traded. They have virtually no competition. It's constrained because of the structure of its retailing industry. I mean, there's a great microeconomic story about why the productivity in Japan food processing is so low. The average productivity of an economy, of a whole country, is the aggregation of the productivity of every single individual worker. So each worker's weight going into that productivity calculation is equal. There are more Japanese workers in food processing than in steel, cars, machine tools, and computers added together. So food processing alone has more impact on the standard of living in Japan than all these other sectors combined. And then you get to the service industries. I don't know how many of you have ever lived or spent much time in Japan or known Japanese housewives who come and live a time in this country, but basically the Japanese housewives don't want to go home for a whole variety of reasons. It was cheaper at one time to fly from Tokyo to San Francisco by Japanese-made consumer electronics and fly back to Japan. You saved money. Retailing productivity in Japan, 50% of the U.S. Housing construction, 40%. And you can just see these are huge domestic service sectors. It's not hard to see how when you average this up, you get roughly 70% of the U.S. And yet we didn't see the component that was contributing to the productivity coming way down below the U.S. Japan is a valuable example in another way that I've begun to talk about even after the book has come out. And that is all this is happening in one country. The Washington Consensus that came out in the early 90s about good economic policy had a variety of prescriptions about what you needed to do for success. And yet, here we have a country that has the same Washington Consensus conditions across the board for its sectors, and yet we're getting huge differences in the sector performance. These sectors are performing under the same fiscal policy, same monetary policy, same exchange rate policy, same labor market, same capital market, same rule of law, same healthcare system, same education system, and yet we're getting these huge differences in performance. So obviously the Washington Consensus missed something fundamental, although they did say in their last point some throwaway line about you've got to have regulation that promotes competition or something like that. But none of them knew what that meant, and so nobody's been able to interpret it or follow it. Well, this is what that means. That differences in the productivity, which come in all cases from interesting microeconomic causal stories related to regulation, law, protection of incumbents, what have you. Retailing is the story of mom-and-pop stores. In Japan, 50% of employment in retailing is in mom and pop. In France, it's 25%. In the U.S., it's 12%. The evolution of retailing into more productive formats has gone much further in France than in Japan and much further in the U.S. than in France. Why is that? Well, in Japan, the mom and pops are protected. Subsidized loans that allow them to live off the loans. High capital gains taxes, so they have no incentive to sell some of the most valuable real estate in the world on which they sit, and low estate taxes. So basically their estates pay off the subsidized loans, so they can just live basically without having to sell anything. The more productive formats can't come in and compete against them, in part because they can't get land. Initially, no stores greater than 10,000 square feet could be built. That was just a law. The U.S. and the Europeans objected to that, so the Japanese changed the law to be more like the law in France. You had to satisfy environmental concerns. And guess who was on the local board who determined whether the environmental concerns were satisfactorily satisfied? The incumbents in the retailing industry. So Carrefour, who's probably the most powerful, successful retail in the world, at least I would have said that up until 2 years ago, made a big entry into Japan, and 2 years ago, Carrefour decided to withdraw from Japan. It just could not succeed. So retailing is blocked in terms of its evolution into higher productivity formats. Next conclusion. Education is not as immediately important as most people think. I love to give this conclusion, especially among a bunch of educators, but the World Bank also is very fond of this conclusion. It's not that I'm saying education is unimportant. It's just that for these poor countries, education is not the binding constraint. Every poor country we studied could double its GDP per capita with the existing educational establishment. And that's actually very good news, because when you think about it, if you had to really change the educational institutions in these countries and then put a couple of cohorts of workers through the educational system, we're talking about 50 years before you really have much of an effect. And that's, we don't have 50 years anymore. The point here is that just because people aren't educated in developing countries does not mean that they're dumb. It does not mean that they don't have good general capabilities. In our Western world, we generally associate high levels of education with high levels of general abilities. And we'd like to think the correlation is 1.0. Probably the people in this room would all like to think the correlation is 1.0. But even in our societies, it's not 1.0. And it's certainly not 1.0 in the poor countries. These people can be trained. And the great lesson of the last 50 years is that the large, organized, competitive, multinational firms of any nationality now, not just the U.S., but European, certainly Japanese, and even now in the poor countries, the multinationals, have shown they can go to any corner of the world and train the local workforce. They can train the local workforce because it's not dumb. I mean, they can be trained to do high skill work in a workforce assembly line sense. I'm not talking about computer scientists, but I'm talking about the so-called blue-collar workforce. And that means that we can make progress very fast, and in many cases we are, because the productivity of those locally trained workforces is often 95% of home country productivity. We got onto this conclusion first in this country, because back in 1991, again, the conventional wisdom was the U.S. was going down the drain because its labor force was uneducated, dumb, and a Japanese politician actually added, and lazy. And then these great Japanese manufacturing companies came to this country and showed they could do what U.S. managers couldn't do. They could take these local inputs, this local workforce, and they could get up to 95% of home country productivity. And this was great news for the U.S. because that meant our problem was not the labor force. If it had been the labor force, we are again talking about a 50-year problem. Our problem was management. And in most companies, with the possible exception of General Motors, we've dealt with that problem. That's easier, a faster problem to deal with. I'll give you one example of this. This is from the construction case in Brazil. We benchmarked the building of a high-rise in Houston with the building of a high-rise in Sao Paulo. And the labor productivity in Houston was about four times that of Sao Paulo. The quality of the two constructions were about the same. And we looked at why that was. It's for several reasons, but perhaps the most important reason was that the U.S. construction industry was organized by subcontractors. Most of the work was done by subcontractors, and they specialized in certain areas, and they trained their people up to very high levels of skill. In Brazil, for a whole variety of reasons, having to do with lack of mortgages and difficulty of getting things together on a fixed schedule, the work is done mostly by general contractors. And then we looked at, well, who was doing the work? In Brazil, it was former agricultural workers, primarily from Northeast Brazil. In Houston, the majority of the workers on this project were former Mexican agricultural workers, most of whom did not speak English, and about half of whom were illiterate in Spanish. And I'm smiling now at my friends here from California, because I'm wondering if they by any chance had the same experience I had when we built a house out there, in that we had a wonderful carpenter crew, and they were making a very complicated diagonal cut in a huge glulam structure load-bearing wood beam, and I was wondering how they were going to get that angle right, because if they didn't get it right, then this a crane was lifting this, going to lift this beam up and pull the house up with it, pull the roof up with it. And I went over and started talking to the carpenter, and I said, well, and it was, took me 15 to 20 seconds into that conversation to realize he didn't understand a word I was saying. But he was extremely skilled worker. So, we need education for many reasons, but it's not for vocational reasons for doubling GDP per capita in many of these poor countries. This is perhaps the most important new conclusion from the whole body of work, and that is that distortions in competition in product markets are the most important factor in holding back productivity improvement, far more important than labor or capital market problems. Labor and capital market problems get all the attention because that's where the data is. In order to get the data to analyze the product market, you've got to do a very, very deep dive. The distortions mean privileges granted in one way or another, special favors, exclusions, one way or another that prevent more productive firms from putting competitive pressure, either through lowering prices or better marketing or higher value products, putting pressure on the incumbents and forcing the incumbents to either improve their productivity or they have to drop out of the business. That's how economies evolve. I mean, it really is, at the simplest level, a created destruction process, as that is commonly understood. When that process is blocked and incumbents are protected, it doesn't happen. Mansur Olson, who some of you, if you're economists, know, was really a very well-respected political economist at the University of Maryland. He wrote a book just before he died called Power and Prosperity, in which he said, yes, we've got this big problem. He labeled them special interests. And it's very interesting how one of the presidential candidates is now picking up on the special interest phraseology. But anyway, he said, but we can deal with special interests because by and large they're relatively small, and when the intellectual elite becomes aware of the special interests, they will get rid of it. Unfortunately, he was wrong on both counts. In poor countries, the special interests are pervasive. Every country has some. It's all a matter of degree. But in poor countries, the poorer the country, the more pervasive are the special interests. And in many cases, especially as you get into poor and poorer countries, the intellectual elite is part of the special interests and self-deals itself. I'll show you the one case that is most analytic about distortions in the product market and how competition drives good productivity improvement. This is a case from the U.S. banking industry. Back in the 60s and 70s, the U.S. had three lazy, sleepy oligopolies. We've already talked about steel and automobiles. The third one was retail banking. Basically, prices were fixed on deposits. There was no price competition. So competition was the convenience of the branch offices, the sociability of the tellers, the quality of the coffee, you know, anything you could think of to try to differentiate yourself, but you couldn't use price because that was fixed, and so productivity didn't change much. Some of you were alive at that time, and they remember that the money market rate in the U.S. began to run well above this fixed deposit rate. The fixed deposit rate was 5%, the money market rate was up about 9%, and some very entrepreneurial, innovative money market mutual fund people on Wall Street said, wow, how can we exploit this? And they said, what if we began to offer checking services on our money market mutual funds? And they said, well, it's not obvious that it's against the law. Let's try it and see. I mean, that's the spirit. Let's try it and see if somebody stops us. So they did, and all of us then raced to switch. And of course, then the banks came screaming into Washington saying, stop this, stop this, stop this, stop this. And the Fed, to its credit, and the control of the currency, said it's not obviously it's against the banking law, and it's clearly in the interest of consumers. So we're going to let this go and see what happens. So more people switched, and the banks came back, please lift us from this regulation so we can compete with these guys. Get rid of Regulation Q. So in 1982, Regulation Q was lifted by the Treasury, and to the day, productivity started going up because price competition broke out in the money center banks in New York. Waiting in the wings was the IBM 360 computer, an innovation made in heaven for applying to the back rooms of retail banks. So under this price competition, the pressure to reduce costs was enormous, so basically the 360s came in and the people went out. It was like a neutron bomb had gone off in the backroom operations of these retail banks. In Europe, the computers came in, but the people stayed. And that's the difference in many cases, simply because the European banks, the big money center banks, were still not competing on price. But in the U.S., they were competing on price. And so you can see what happened to productivity. And this story went over and over again 113 times in the 113 case studies we did around the world, 40 of whom I summarized in the book. Oh, another new conclusion coming out of this work, and I'm going to try to explain this in enough detail so you understand it, but it's going to be hard for you to really grasp the details of its implications. Today's big governments in poor countries are a handicap that today's rich countries did not have when they were poor. That's a mouthful. So it's not an intentional tongue twister, but it is. I will try to explain what this is all about, because it's a huge, huge problem. This chart shows government spending as percent of GDP on the vertical axis. A horizontal axis is GDP per capita, and for this chart, we've shifted the U.S. and France back to the point in time when they had economic performance equivalent to today's poor countries. So it's back to the GDP per capita of Brazil, India, and Russia today. That was 1913 for U.S. and France. For Japan, it was 1950. And as you can see, back in 1913, U.S. and France had far smaller governments, far smaller spending. Even Japan, as I said, the one country to go from poor to rich in the last 100 years, had a size of government maybe 60% of what today's poor countries have. Why does this matter? It matters because if you have a government this big, you have to finance it. You have to finance it. How do you finance it? You finance it through taxes. If you're a poor country, how do you raise those taxes? The only way you can raise those taxes is taxing the large, organized, yes, more productive firms. You cannot use the individual income tax when you're poor. You can't do it. You can't administer it. It wouldn't be worth the cost to go after every single wage earner in the country. Now, why is that a problem? Well, and this is not just profit tax. This is all the taxes. Employment tax, sales tax, value-added taxes. All that is how these governments finance their expenditures. And that has to, if it's raised through the corporation, it has to be built into the cost structure of these corporations. They have to price for it. They have to collect these taxes in the prices they charge. So, what's wrong with that? Everybody pays these taxes, right? So the playing field is still equal. Well, not so in a poor country. That's true in the U.S. today, roughly, and it's true in the rich democracies in Europe and in Japan, in that, well, everybody sort of pays these taxes, so the playing field is roughly equal. It's not true entirely in Italy, and Italy has some problems for this reason. The black market is a constraint on Italy's progress. But in the poor countries, basically, these well-organized, productive firms, their competition is not other tax-paying, productive, large corporations. Their competition are the informal, small, relatively unorganized, relatively unproductive firms. And of course, the way a country gets rich is it basically evolves out of those firms into the larger, more productive enterprises. In many cases, in Brazil, we first got onto this. In Brazil, we were puzzled by why the retailing industry wasn't evolving faster. And the reason it wasn't evolving faster was that the more productive firms were having a great deal of difficulty underpricing the informal retailers in order to put them out of business and in order to grow and to increase employment in their form of doing business. And in Russia, it was just black and white. I mean, there was no evolution simply because the formal firms could not underprice the informal firms. So new enterprises were cropping up that were also informal, and everybody thought, well, they must be more productive. We measured their productivity. It didn't increase simply because they didn't have to do it. I mean, they wanted to stay below the radar screen so they didn't have to pay these taxes. Now, this didn't matter back in 1913 for France and the U.S., because obviously the same thing applied, but it didn't matter because the overall taxes that had to be raised were just not that much. So they didn't distort the price competition the way the taxes now distort the price competition in the poor countries. And Japan in 1950, you know, 20%, it probably makes sense to have a bigger government than the U.S. had and France had in 1913. There's more we know how to do in terms of health care and things like that. But all the social welfare programs and a lot of the economic planning, especially in the India government, that is just now holding back progress as opposed to promoting it. And there's nothing that these countries can do to get out of that, because the U.S. back in 1913, but back 200 years ago when it started, when it first had a government big enough that it needed to finance it, started taxing corporations. I mean, this is what all people have to do at that stage of development, not out of philosophy, not out of principle. It's because these are the only entities you know about, you know where they keep their money, and you know that when they don't pay the taxes, you know where to go find their money. And so everybody has to tax corporations for that reason. It's not a philosophical or an economic principle. How do these countries reduce the size of their government in order to get rid of this problem? Beats me. Four countries have done it. We looked: Ireland, New Zealand, and Canada. By the way, the Scandinavians also did it, but they went from the upper stratosphere to the lower stratosphere. They're still very high, so I don't count Sweden, Finland, and Norway in this. But of countries that went sort of in the zone of reason, those are the four. Three of those are rich countries. There's only one poor country that's done it. That's Chile. Chile went from about where Brazil is today to where Japan was in 1950. Exactly what I would have prescribed that they need to do. That's the good news. The bad news is it took a military government to do it. And I'm not here to recommend a military government for all these countries. I'm just illustrating how difficult a problem this is, and there is no resolution in sight. So, as a result, in Brazil, you can see it's going in the wrong direction. Informality is increasing, informality is coming down. And Lula has been unable to, despite his promises to change the pensions of the civil servants, which are written into the Constitution, he can't get it done because the beneficiaries of this system, the technocrats, would have to write the law change, the people would have to pass the law, the politicians benefit from the system, and the judges who'd rule on the constitutionality of the law benefit from the system. So he's got absolutely zero progress. And civil servant pensions in Brazil are 6% of GDP. In the U.S., they're 1.5% of GDP. So how does a country ever become rich? It almost looks like it's too hard. I mean, it's just a miracle if that were to happen. So I did go back, and the last three chapters are a little bit about the U.S. story. It's the only one I knew, and I've, since that time, what I've been exploring and hope to write about before very long is the story in other countries. How did the U.S. overcome special interests? Well, it didn't completely. No country overcomes special interests completely. But the basic process was really through the democratic process. Democracies are necessary for this. They're not sufficient, but they are necessary. You also have to have certain aspects of democracies, because democracies have the weakness that the majority can gang up on the minority, or there can be an effective majority that also has its way. What happened in the U.S. is that there was the realization intuitively and implicitly, more than explicitly, that the purpose of an economy is for consumption. I mean, that is the reason we have economies. Production is not an end. It's a means to an end. The end is consumption. And so consumers' interests are what's at stake here. And there's really been some very good historical work, Balin at Harvard, and particularly Gordon Wood at Brown. The Radicalism of the American Revolution came out in the middle 90s, won the Pulitzer Prize, documents how at the time of the revolution in this country, there was a total change in mentality from the feudal system, where basically consumption was a luxury, viewed as a luxury, to which the landed aristocracy was entitled, and the common man was entitled to subsistence, enough food and shelter to survive, and presumably his or her reward was in the next life. The revolution changed all that. With the political philosophy of individual rights, suddenly a few million farmers felt like, well, we have the right to consume also. And so the surplus from agricultural activities ended up in individual consumption, and there was an explosion of consumerism, which is well documented historically in this country. So Walmart did not bring consumerism to the U.S., the revolution did. Then by the time the Industrial Revolution got rolling, the U.S. was in a different place from most everybody else in the world. So the abuses of the trust and the cartels were met with immediately and decisively. Politicians in this country learned over 100 years ago that they could be successful politically by campaigning on the basis of promoting consumer rights. So the Sherman Act of 1896, which is known as an antitrust act, had many other aspects of competition policy and principle in it, which most countries in the world today actually have not come up to. It took two or three decades for that act and its implications to be worked through. The Clayton Act was necessary, many important court decisions, rulings by the Federal Trade Commission, but by the 1930s, the U.S. was in a distinctly different place. Insider trading became illegal in the U.S. in 1932. It didn't become illegal in Germany until 5 years ago. I mean, there is, just, and in most countries in the world, it is not illegal today. So there's just a huge, huge difference in sort of economic policy regimes around the world. And it's because consumers have basically forced this, and it's been through their work and with politicians that these special interests have been overcome, because the incumbents, the politicians who benefit from support, political and financial, from the incumbents, all have to be battled with. I mean, and every country has that problem. Just to give you a flavor of the historical evolution in the U.S. In 1906, over 100 years ago, La Follette of Wisconsin, in his maiden speech on the Senate floor, said the welfare of all people as consumers should be the supreme consideration of government. Walter Lippmann, 1914. Some of you know Walter Lippmann. He was the premier commentator on this country in the first half of the 20th century. We hear a great deal about the class consciousness of labor. My own observation is that in America today, consumers' consciousness is growing very much faster. The U.S. never developed the labor-capital split that dominates the politics of so many countries. Consumers view both as special interests, both labor and capital as special interests. Neither were to be trusted. Both needed to be governed. Franklin Roosevelt, I believe we're at the threshold of fundamental change of public economic thought. In the future, we're going to think less about the producer and more about the consumer. And John Kennedy, and I actually heard him say this when he was campaigning for president, the consumer is the only man in our economy without hyper lobbyist. I intend to be that lobbyist. In virtually no country today do you hear politicians talking like this. Europe has come some distance and is accelerating. The European Commission has made a big difference in Europe in this regard. And so consumer awareness is moving good. And the competition authorities in Europe are behaving totally different than they did 20 years ago. So it's making huge progress. But you move beyond Europe and you just don't see much of this at all. And without this kind of thing, which as you can tell in this story, at least in the American experience, is a very deep-rooted, long-in-coming process. It just illustrates to me how hard this process is going to be, and the fact that we just may very well not be successful in trying to get this done. On that depressing note, I will stop. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. Ike, you want to make some comments, and then we'll open up the discussion.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Bill. Always, I've heard you give variations of this two or three times, and I always learn something different every time. I really enjoyed it. I thought I'd do a couple of different things. First, since I've been at Treasury working on tax issues for about the last 9 months, I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about it from a tax perspective. We recently issued a report at the end of the year on corporate tax policy, and implicit in that was some discussion on productivity and economic growth that I think is very relevant to that. And then also there's a couple issues here that I think need to be discussed, or is a good place for them to be discussed, talking about specifically some proposals that ITIF has had in terms of productivity policy. So let me just kind of lay out a couple of these issues. So I think if I had to summarize Bill's remarks in just a few words, I said something that we really need to do whatever we can in order to increase competition in all sectors of the economy, and that seems to be very strongly correlated with strong productivity. If you kind of look at the tax economists and where they look at, naturally they're very circumscribed in terms of their worldview, but a lot of the discussion has been towards how do you manipulate the tax code, since that seems to be, for better or worse, and most definitely, I think, for worse, the place where we try to do so much of our domestic policy. Their approach is to expense capital equipment. And the whole idea, of course, is that if you allow firms to deduct the money they spend on new plant and equipment immediately from their taxes rather than over a period of years, according to the more or less the fiscal depreciation, then the actual cost of capital to firms becomes cheaper. Individuals are working with more capital, therefore they can become more productive. And so I think if you look at certainly the Republican-ish economists, most of them seem to fall into this camp. And I would say most of the economists in tax policy in Treasury, whether they're career or politically appointed, fall closely into this camp. The lawyers, on the other hand, don't believe this at all. And I think it's most typified by Martin Sullivan, who writes for Tax Notes and is a very very prominent and very influential expert on tax policy. And his point is that it makes no sense to go to expensing for a couple of different reasons. And the first one is a mere political problem. That if you're going to do that, allow firms as of January 1st, 2009 to fully deduct all the money they spend on new plant and equipment rather than over a period of years, then a lot of companies who made significant expenditures on plant equipment in 2007 and 2008 are going to say, wait a minute, this puts us at a gigantic disadvantage. We're being penalized for doing this. Now, economists will say, well, you should be penalized because we want to do expensing because it gives us a lot of bang for the buck. We don't want to reward you for investments you've already made. We want to reward people for future investments in plant and equipment. That is, we're getting the biggest marginal boost from the tax break that we're giving. So Martin Sullivan says, politically, there's no way to keep transition relief from occurring. There's no way for Congress to be able to hold its hands and not start giving out benefits to those people who complain because they made the investments in 2007 and 2008. Therefore, the whole idea of concentrating on new investment, lowering that cost, is totally out the window. His other point is that this is very politically dicey. It's politically dicey because certain industries benefit much greater from this than other industries. Manufacturing industries in particular benefit greatly from it. Financial services, not so much. It's not a very capital-intensive industry. They have some computer expenditures and so on, but they don't benefit all that much. In our report, which is on our on the Treasury website, you probably have to email me to find it because, as far as I can tell, the Treasury website is the most indecipherable website that exists at the moment. But we have a list in this report, and we're actually going to have booklets published that should be out any day now that hopefully you'll be able to find of the effective tax rates. By industry, and what's really interesting, too, looking at this list is that the industry with the lowest effective tax rate is agriculture. The next is manufacturing. You go down; it's basically in reverse order of when did this industry become politically large and influential. And this more recently it happened, the higher your effective tax rate is. So if there's a better measure out there for how lobbying pays off, I'd like to see it. Martin Sullivan says, let's forget about this whole expensing. The transition relief means it's not going to do anything. Politically, we're going to have too many industries against this. They're going to be too effective at fighting this. And also, the better pitch to make to politicians, to individuals, to voters, is that we want to lower corporate tax rates, which is a really difficult thing to get people's minds around unless you think about these things a lot, is that it improves our international competitiveness. So not only is that a better sale, but that might actually be a more effective reason to reduce the cost of capital, to attract more capital, to keep firms from domestic firms from investing too much abroad in, to draw more foreign capital in. So Rob Atkinson and his colleagues here at the ITIF have kind of a split the difference proposal, and it's in I think they're probably the report that's gotten more discussion, at least in my world, than any other report the ITIF's put out since their inception. And the idea is to expense solely IT investment. And I think it's an interesting idea because if you start thinking about tax cuts as costing the government money, it's certainly much cheaper to do. It's, you don't have to give to all new equipment, you're just giving to a small fraction. It gives you more industry equity, because every industry has some kind of investment in IT. And again, you know, the evidence seems to suggest that there's more bang for the buck. But that kind of, papers by Sickle and research by Jorgensen seem to suggest that if you're trying to figure out how to improve productivity growth, that that's where your investments ought to go. So I think the first thing, I didn't mean to, I should have given Bill a little bit more warning, but I'd like to have just a little bit of a discussion since the two are here about kind of the various pros and cons of approaching it this way. And then just a couple of other things I'd like to react to in terms of Bill's talk. There's been a couple of articles quite recently about China and some of the problems they're seeing in trying to increase their productivity growth. In fact, there was a New York Times article, I think it was about 10 days ago, and it suggests that the Chinese realize exactly what Bill was saying, that they're not organizing their plants effectively, and they're starting to bump up into the Japan problem. You just can't keep throwing shovels and tools at your workers and expect productivity to go up. And so China has decided they're going to dramatically increase the amount of money they invest in management education. Basically, they want to start a whole new set of MBA schools. So I'd like to hear Bill opine just a little bit about that, you know, whether this is a good idea, and also if it is, maybe two or three things he could advise them or other countries that need to do something like that. Consumers as a political force, again, I'm approaching it from more of a political economy perspective rather than a political perspective. I think I've thought about this before. You know, I read the book when it came out in 2004, and it's kind of implicit in there, and it occurred to me back in 2004 that this is something that ought to be done, and it would be done if there's a way that someone could make lots of money off of this, and I've been thinking about it for 4 years, and I still can't figure out how to do that. How can you make lots of money lobbying for a group of consumers? ARP has this fantastic formula, right? The ARP people are geniuses, right? We're going to take a large group, but relatively homogeneous group. We're going to offer them a few services that are a little bit, give them these kind of bargains, and we make tons and tons of money. And then once they got this thing going up, then all of a sudden they could start doing their lobbying arm. And they're an incredibly effective lobbying group, as Congresswoman Johnson would say. I mean, they're just all over the place. They have all kinds of researchers now. In my quest to figure out how I, as an economist, can be rich, I'm trying to figure out, does this ARP model apply to anything else out there? And I don't know. Maybe home buyers, but they already have enough going their way, right? We already do so too many favors for them. So Bill, I hope you can tell us how we can organize a lobbying entity for consumers in some way, and I just can't do it. The last thing, a little anecdote I want to share with Bill. There was a talk here, I can't remember how long ago, when we presented a couple months ago, Broken Buildings, and is talking about, you know, Bill talks about how much better building productivity here is in the United States versus elsewhere. And, you know, this wonderful book, Broken Buildings, says, look, you know, our productivity in the building trade, construction trade, is nothing to nothing to brag about here. Productivity has scarcely budged in 20 or 30 years, and he attributes most of it to this whole notion of the practice of cost plus pricing. There's no real incentives that builders have to economize on labor or become more productive. And in fact, I have a great story about low expectations. So I'm from in terms of the building profession. So I have I'm from Peoria, Illinois, a few miles outside of Peoria, Illinois, in a small town called Mossel. And my parents live in the same house that they did when I was born 43 years ago. And neighbors of ours, people who were neighbors when I was growing up, moved back to India 30 years ago. And we occasionally kept in touch. And they came back to visit my parents after 30 years. And their parting remarks when they went to India was that Peoria is a village even by Indian standards, which is my all-time favorite description of Peoria. But so there's a little there's a bridge that goes that you have to go on that goes over a small creek when you leave Peoria to get to Mossville. And it just so happened 30 years ago when our friends left and they're driving to the airport, they had to cross this bridge and it was out, it was being repaired. And so they come back and they come at the bridge 30 years later, someone's working on the bridge, and they come and, wow, you guys are still working on that bridge. How funny. We had to explain to them, no, we actually finished it, it broke up, and now we're building again. And then the last little comment I'd like to add here before I'll sit down is I think there's still this notion out there. I think economists understand that economic growth in the United States is significantly better than it is almost everywhere else, and certainly in Europe. But I think the non-economist doesn't appreciate that at all. I think the typical non-economist sees Europe as being somehow this alternative model that seems to be working just as well, if not better, than in the United States. And we get this all the time. And there's a whole class of politicians who kind of see us as doing much better if we can somehow move to the European model, and, you know, blithely ignoring all these problems. And I thought about this when I'm organizing a. I went to undergraduate school at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, and we're organizing an alumni event here. And I was talking to one of my teachers, and who's coming out for this event, and it brought back when I started getting this notion about European superiority. So, in her class, I began this little shorthand. It was an architectural art appreciation class. And the notion is whenever I would hear something that equivalated to, you know, talking about the superiority of European culture, European economy, European civilization, I would always write this, Europe equals better. And I would always show this, I had all my classes with a couple of my friends, I'd always show this. And at the end of my 4 years, I tried to count up all the times I wrote E equals B on one of my computers, on one of my notebooks. And it was well over 100 times. This is... It was 25 years ago, I know, but this is kind of an ingrained sense that their economy, their culture, the way they organize things is somehow inherently better. And I think there's certainly things I admire about Europe, but when we start talking about the superiority of the American economy versus the European economy, I feel like not many people are listening to us, not many people have heard us. And so I think Bill's work is really important because it kind of lays out the gigantic differences we have in terms of productivity, between us, and also how this is going to translate in future economic growth. So I think this is, to me, this is why I keep pitching the book to everyone. I think this is a message that we have to say over and over and over and over again until people actually hear us. So thank you very much.
Thank you. One of the
things about being in the U.S., if you're in the U.S., at least our view is we can always do better. And if you're in India, you look at the U.S., or if you're in some countries, look at the U.S., what an amazing place the U.S. is. But I think we can do better, and so I think a lot of the comments you made in your book and in your remarks equally apply to the U.S. Maybe I shouldn't say equally, they also apply to the U.S. There are lots of sectors in the U.S. where we have protection and limited competition. And we also have policies in the U.S. that favor inefficient small companies over big companies. One of them is expensing. You know, we have expensing if you're a small company. When I did my taxes last year, I was able to, I think, expense my Lexmark $40 printer that I bought, because I do consulting on the side of here in the Herb River. So I was able to expense that, but if you're a big company, obviously you can't expense that. So we do have some biases in the tax code that way. So why don't we, I think we've got 15, 20 minutes. Why don't we open it up for questions or comments for either Ike or Bill? If you can identify yourself first, please.
Yes, I am Cliff Waldman. I'm an economist with the Manufacturers Alliance. Question for Dr. Lewis, if I may. I wanted to push the education conclusion a little bit, because I've had to learn a little bit of that literature for a few projects and papers as of late. And one of the things that I've learned is that a lot of the mistake in the empirical analysis of the impact of education on economic growth, et cetera, is to treat education empirically as attainment. Educational attainment. High school graduation, college graduates, PhDs in physics, et cetera. The better way that people like Eric Hanushek at the Hoover Institute, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but a very good economist at the Hoover Institute, say the much more important variable are skills, and particularly cognitive skills. Now, there's a very good reason that we look at attainment more than skills. It's a lot easier to get data that we can agree on in attainment rather than skills, but the skills data are coming up in terms of their usefulness because of these international testing programs, and et cetera. And they're finding that skills, cognitive skills, have a very direct impact, particularly in the developing world, on economic growth, on income, which presumably has to have some tie to productivity. So I'm just wondering if we don't quite yet know enough about education to really make a conclusion about its impact on productivity.
Well, that's probably true about everything having to do with productivity. We wish we knew more. I think, though, that the last 50 years hold an awful lot of valuable empirical evidence about what causes what. And this conclusion on education, by the way, is not unique to our work. Some of you are familiar with the work of Bill Easterly when he was at the World Bank and now New York University. And the really hard-headed World Bank economists have also come to much the same conclusion that we did from the micro world. And they're doing the various regression analyses. The thing that's new, that's really new, is this training capability, the building of skills. I don't think we're denying the importance of skills. It's just that there's a much more efficient shortcut way to get much, if not all, the skills you need through on-the-job training. That on-the-job training can replace an awful lot of inefficient acquisition of those kinds of skills in education systems. In order to improve the education system so they become efficient in training those skills and other things is a huge undertaking, which you all must do. But we can't use that as an excuse for the poor countries not making more progress now, because we now know we can short-circuit that by on-the-job training of the appropriate skills, matching the individual skills against the actual tasks needed today on the job. That's not a long-term solution, but it certainly is a way of improving economic performance considerably today without having to wait forever.
A lot of hands. Why don't we go, Greg, and then we'll...
Greg Tassett from NIST.
Dan.
But that paradigm only works for a short period of time, because for a given labor skill level, you can only add so much capital, and especially capital with a certain technological content. So you put a limit on growth, no matter how well you organize it, if you don't also simultaneously invest in the education that you're investing in technology to improve productivity and capital.
Well, I don't actually see it that way, because for a poor country today, I've talked about all the problems of coming along today with big government and all this, that, and the other. One of the huge advantages of coming along today as a poor country is that basically you don't have to invent anything. You don't have to come up with any innovations yourself. Those innovations have already been made. The great problem in the world today is diffusing the existing set of innovations from one application in one geographic place to another. And so as a result, you don't need the great R&D laboratories that have already produced these huge innovations. If we just applied the innovations that are known today in the poor countries, we make huge progress. So we have to have people who are skilled at adopting and adapting to local circumstances, but this is different from high-tech development. Basically, that's not something any of the poor countries need to do today. In fact, they shouldn't be working on it. They shouldn't be spending their money that way.
If you tell them they don't need to improve their educational system, you put a ceiling on growth because they will run up against that as the economy grows.
Well, I didn't say they shouldn't improve their education system. I just said they can't use their current education system as an excuse for not making progress in other ways.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Lewis, I was struck by your comment, which I agreed with, that it was in the competitiveness and productivity debates of the 80s and 90s, it wasn't labor that was the problem or capital, it was really management. And as I thought about that, I realized that I'm sure your colleagues at McKinsey who were selling management services were delighted with that conclusion when you came out with that. But I actually wondered if you would sort of comment really on the work of the ITIF, and the thesis of this organization in the whole productivity debate. And I guess if I look back on the last 20 years, the IT revolution that not only blossomed in the United States, but then was absorbed very rapidly by one industry after another in this country, had a profound impact on productivity and competitiveness. And I just wondered if you'd sort of comment on that observation.
I actually was hoping to avoid,
having to
touch this subject, because I'm sure now, after I speak, people are going to have regrets about inviting me. I have said many times in public that information technology is not the solution to any economy's fundamental problems. The Japanese would like to have thought that when they were first running into trouble back in the 90s, and you go to Korea, and they say much the same thing, and India. I mean, this is in part to a comment either Ike or Rob made, but I once did a back-of-the-envelope calculation and said, suppose India did all the software work for the whole world. How much employment would that generate in India? The employment would comprise 2% of the India's workforce. It's just that all these sectors are so small that IT doesn't solve any of the fundamental problems of retailing or wholesaling or automobile manufacturing in a country like India. We did look in the U.S., and I think this is maybe more pertinent for your question, at the acceleration in productivity in the U.S. in the last 5 years of the decade of the 90s. We did this study in 2001. And certainly, information technology was a major contributor to the acceleration in our productivity growth. The contribution came on the investment side through computer assembly and the manufacturing of semiconductors. And the acceleration came from the huge productivity gains in those sectors. The sectors themselves aren't big employment sectors, but their gains were huge. So when you put them into the whole, they explained about a third. But the other two-thirds really were not directly related to IT. They were other factors in retailing and wholesaling primarily that did hark back to earlier applications of information technology, but they were not tied to the acceleration in investment in information technology in the second half of the 90s. The problem was a lot of that investment, from McKinsey's point of view, was wasted. I mean, there were not the applications there for it. Firms didn't know how to use it. They may be doing it now. We haven't updated that work, so we don't really know. But the acceleration in wholesaling and retailing came through increasing competitive intensity. Basically, Walmart's competitors figured that they had to either change the way they were doing their retailing business or Walmart was going to take an increasing share unless the Justice Department stopped them. And wholesaling was actually the conversion of a backward mom and pop local industry, the most backward commercial industry that we had, into what we might call industrialization. Huge consolidations occurred in the industry, assembly lines were put in, and information technology of the early 1980s was applied in the wholesaling industry for the first time. The great challenge in information technology is whether it's being used in its applications productively. And in some cases it is, and in some cases it's not. Hopefully we will learn over time how to use it. But retail banking basically made no use of its huge investment in the early 90s in new information technology. Consumer relations models yielded virtually no value to the customer. I mean, this is a McKinsey consulting conclusion. So it depends not on how much capital you apply, but how you use it. That's the question. And in growth accounting, and a lot of the work of Dale Jorgensen and Kevin Stereau at the Fed in New York, is really assuming that the information technology investment is going to yield the average capital output ratio. And that's an accounting assumption. It's not a causal relationship. You have to actually look sector by sector to see what happens when the information technology is applied to tell whether it really has made a difference or not. I would really love for somebody to repeat now what we did back in 2001 and see if the value of the application information technology at the sector level, at the firm level, has actually improved from what it was in the late 90s.
What it's worth, the Orange Report that's out there, Digital Prosperity, goes through most of the literature on that and cites a number of studies on the share from IT production and IT usage. The OECD and Jorgensen numbers are a little lower than 30%. They're closer to 20. Bill and I would agree. I think that when I've been to India and talking about India can grow its IT industry to infinite, and it's not going to make a difference, really. It's the application of that in other sectors. I guess I would just be, I'm obviously more bullish on that. I look at a company like Walmart, and I don't see it being able to do a lot of what it's doing without IT. So I think you put those two factors together of intense competition and labor, excuse me, product markets that force companies to do this. IT is the tool that enables some of these new business models to occur. It also is clearly driving efficiencies in things that just we see every day with kiosks at airports, a whole set of issues, so a whole set of technologies to make things more efficient, including on the factory floor. You know, this revolution in manufacturing today, the revolution in manufacturing is largely an IT revolution about being able to design things. Tim Eglock here from Siemens, if you want to talk about the company that's doing all that, Tim from Detroit can tell you about that. Anyway, other question, I think there was...
I have one question. I'm Rick Hargrove. I'm not an economist. I'm a computer scientist and retired from Microsoft a few years ago. There was a comment about E equals B by Ike, and as it relates to productivity, and I think the assumption in here, in probably wide agreement, is that productivity is better. But that isn't shared, I think, by most voters. And that's the political dilemma. Most voters, I think, especially in this current climate, would say that productivity means I'm going to lose my job because I'm going to be either outsourced by somebody who accepts a lower wage or by a machine, or a robot, or a computer, or whatever. And so I think productivity is the crux of the problem America faces, either because of international competition or because of job requirements, companies being profitable enough and free enough, without, which I love the term, competition distortion, without the government coming in and constraining businesses so much that they can't hire employees because of increased taxes or workers' comp or whatever. So the challenge is to convince the voting population that productivity is important, and then if you can do that, then they'll support public policies that will increase productivity. One example, which I didn't hear you mention, I apologize if you do in the book, but transportation, for example, increasing or decreasing the cost of transportation would increase any company's competitiveness that needs to transport their goods throughout the U.S. at least, without hurting their, or in fact in helping their international competition. So IT is, I think, a great tool to increase productivity and lower costs. I actually like capital gains for equipment. capital gains taxes, because it encourages companies to acquire more productivity tools, I think. And transportation costs and anything like that, even communication costs or whatever, if we can increase the ability, reduce the friction of trade and transactions, then we're going to increase American competitiveness. So anyway, I guess my primary question is, do you think the term productivity gain is a political problem? And is there a way to improve its image so that it's easier to influence policy?
Obviously, the conventional wisdom around the world is that productivity is the enemy of employment. And if we think we have problems with that in the U.S., we just need to look at other countries where the resistance to this kind of change is even greater. Our labor laws and practices give us a considerably more flexible workforce than most other countries. Not all, but most other countries. So this problem is true in the U.S., but it's true to a much greater degree in most other countries, and it sort of seems to come out of human nature. We don't like change. If it's trouble, we have to work, we have to adjust, we have to confront new challenges, and we have to learn how to master them. It creates anxiety. Anxiety is painful, and so this ends up in the therapist's corner. But that's just human nature. The only response I've given to that is that I just say, well, 200 years ago, we all were working in agriculture. And now it takes only 3% of the workforce to feed us all. And the other 97% of us aren't sitting around doing nothing. That basically there is a natural process, if you're not making big mistakes in other parts of your economy, where the new jobs and the new areas in more productive enterprises will be created. Many countries block that creation process, and so they are right. Productivity improvement does lead to higher unemployment. But our unemployment track record is just almost unbelievable in comparison with the rest of the world. It's not so the problem is not job creation. 5% unemployment is 15 years ago, nobody would have thought we could have that low a level of employment without raging inflation. So in the end, we're not going to overcome the human nature part of this, that we don't want change, anxiety is painful, we don't like it, and so we're going to try to avoid it. But we just have to resist it as much as possible and make everybody understand as well they can is that you're going to, by and large, end up okay, which is the story for the great bulk of the workforce through all this change. Otherwise, we'd all be sitting around doing nothing because none of us are farmers.
Nancy. On this point, you know, it looks to me like productivity has taken the place now of competition, which 5 years ago was just as ugly a word, and it's one of the reasons why you've got to be careful in talking about health care, including the word competition. But I wonder, and you're all economists, and I'm not, but I feel like you're failing us because you cannot translate for people the benefit to them of either competition or productivity. So we can, in a sense, talk to ourselves accurately about these phenomena. For instance, you talk right now this thing about the middle class. Who gets the benefits of the biggest public spending? The middle class. The poor gets a small smidgen, you know, Medicaid, food stamps, you know, but the middle class gets the mortgage deduction, gets the benefit of employee health deduction, gets a modest tax rate compared to the rest of the world. I mean, it's scandalous how little the middle class knows about the benefits that government gives them that are not available. Look in retirement policy. Look what we've done in retirement policy. We haven't fixed Social Security, and so the poor people still pay 12% of their wages into this system. But the richer you are, the more IRAs, the more pension plans, the more these saving instruments you're able to utilize, each one of which is government subsidized. through tax forgiveness. So, you know, we're not talking to ourselves anymore squarely. This is a big problem in healthcare. I mean, you go to CBO and they cannot estimate what electronic health records will do. I mean, you know. So we can't adopt these because the estimate is always too high. But your economists are doing the same thing. When we talk to ourselves about wages and people say, well, the middle class is doing terribly, their wages haven't gone up. How about the fact that you can buy high quality clothes for a lot less than I could 20 years ago as a proportion of my income? How about the fact that food prices, I mean, we say this, but we don't calculate it in. You know, it's like when we talk about the poor and government, we don't calculate in Medicare and housing subsidies for those who get them. So they don't have any real understanding of what their income is. See, so we're going to have to straighten out how we talk to ourselves about income and benefits, because we're completely unable to talk about productivity. So it looks like all I get out of it is that some of my friends lose their jobs and have to get retrained. See, but we're not able to say, yep, that's true. But you also are able to buy this or that, and you can buy vegetables all year round at the grocery store. I mean, it's too big a problem for me to even lay out for you clearly, but I do think it's a failure of our analytical tools right now. They're not equal to the task. They're talking about the old issues without any regard to the new world. And I know in healthcare it's making change almost impossible. And the only reason that it's going to happen is because it's sort of inevitable. Consumers are going to demand it. Physicians are going to demand it, and it will happen. But it's going to politically, it could actually ignite a new round of exactly the wrong policy making if we can't begin to talk more accurately. Now, maybe you can talk more accurately about it, and I just don't get it.
Well, but I actually have a little something to contribute here.
Good.
But economists have
I'm hoping so. I'm
have
desperate.
Been irresponsible. There is no question about that. And as a physicist, I attribute it to the fact that they can't keep value judgments out of their analytics.
There's a lot to that.
But the basis of this contention and this complaint is that for workers, their productivity has gone up faster than their wages. I mean, that's the bottom line of the argument about wage history, and that the workers have not gotten their share of the productivity increases that they've created because it's been through their work that it's happened. And just within the last 2 or 3 months, two economic papers have come out to straighten this out, and I hope some of you know about this, but they've come from both sides of the aisle. Robert Lawrence at Harvard, who's now here in town at Brookings, and who was a member of Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, who's on the Democratic side, and Marty Feldstein, who is sort of the dean of the conservative economists, in a NBER working paper that just came out in April, both sort out this discrepancy between productivity growth and wage growth. And the resolution of this difference turns out to be, in part, the factor you just said, that wages are not the right way to look at what you compare to productivity. You need to compare total compensation, including all benefits, because in the end, that's what needs to match up against productivity. And I cannot understand for the life of me why these very highly regarded economists haven't made that adjustment, but they haven't in these calculations. You make that adjustment, especially adding in healthcare, whose benefit has become much more costly.
Okay, we just add to that is that you also have to add in that my productivity has to grow enough so that the lower cost products from China can come in, and I could get the benefit of those low cost goods and still see my wages go up. See, because in a sense, if your productivity goes up, it's true, you don't get the whole benefit of it. But you get part of that benefit because first of all, your job stays alive because the foreign competition doesn't completely take over because you've increased productivity enough to compete with it. See? And that's a more complicated story. People do get it. and you can talk to them about this, but we have to be able to talk to them about trade as part of the benefit they earn through productivity. You know,
well,
the
we just have to get the
goods.
Facts straight when we do talk
right.
to them. So there's this benefit fact. The other fact that I cannot believe, but in these comparisons, the economists have been using different deflators for calculating productivity growth and calculating wage growth. And in fact, that's just totally inconsistent. They use the CPI for wage growth, and they use the producer GDP deflator for productivity. And those are different, and if you take those, and actually the right way to do it is deflate the wages by the product deflator, because that's the value of what the worker is producing. When you do that, this difference almost completely disappears, and we now see that average wages in the blue-collar workforce have gone up with blue-collar labor productivity. So,
on that note, I think we should stop. I promise to get editor. I will make a pitch, though. The first paper that was written on this to correct the record was Steve Rose's piece that we did last summer. Steve goes through that in an enormous amount of detail and shows that, as Bill said, not all. There has been some gains in inequality which have meant that the median wage has not grown as fast as productivity. The gap, though, which people like Bob Kuttner, by the way, this is why this debate is out there. People like Bob Kuttner, who have been quoted as saying all the productivity pickup since 95 has gone to the top 1%. So now, not surprisingly, elected officials are reparating that line. Turns out it's just vastly wrong. Of the $36,000 gap between productivity gains and wage gains, $6,000 is attributed to income inequality. $30,000 is attributed to measurement issues, differences in household size, not counting all the benefits, different deflators and all of that stuff. So I agree with Nancy, it's a critical story to get right. It's striking that there's a whole part of the economic left, I guess, as you will, so I would call myself an economic centrist, who basically doesn't either agree with it or doesn't want that story to come out, because if that story comes out, then it leads to a set of different policies. Then if there's a huge divergence between productivity and growth, that leads you to a whole set of other policies. It's striking that we can have these big national debates on this and yet still not really know or care to know what the real evidence says. That's partly, I guess, where Washington is these days. Maybe it wasn't there 15, 20 years ago. So,
there's just one more point I want to make. Yeah. Jason Furman, a respective economist on the left, came up with a paper a couple years ago for the Center of American Progress, and he began this paper in part to dispute certain things in Bill's book, and he came to the conclusion that, if anything, Bill understated the remarkable effect that Walmart has had on the overall well-being of the typical U.S. consumer, estimating it to be in the thousands of dollars.
$26.39 a year.
How much?
$2,639 a year that American consumers are able to get more value out of than that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Walmart.
Well, I think in America we're missing a tremendous opportunity to teach economics in high schools. You know, because they know Walmart, and they all see the competitors of Walmart and what the competitors of Walmart are having to do. So they've got a perfect thing out there. They understand it. We don't even talk about it.
Well, thank you. So, thank great. You. So please join me in thanking Bill and I.
That's very, very